This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Hello and welcome to this June 2018 episode of Radio Astronomy. I'm Ian Todd, the magazine's staff writer, and I'm joined in the studio today by editor Chris Bramley.
Hello.
And production editor Dave Golder.
Hello.
Coming up later in the episode, we'll be talking to astronomer Jerry Gilmore about the latest results from Gaia, which is a mission to 3D map the Milky Way, and we'll also be revealing our top stargazing site for this month. But now we're going to take a look at what we found out while putting together the June edition of the magazine. Dave, you've been looking at Solarium quite a lot this week, I couldn't help but notice.
Yeah, I know. Well, the feature certainly did its magic with me. It's a great feature we got, which is both for people who've never used Solarium before, Solarium being the kind of virtual planetarium software, free open source software, which launched in 2001, unbelievably. I couldn't believe it's been around so long, but now everybody's using it. But the feature's great. It's great for beginners. There's some really in-depth stuff also if you already know Solarium, because the stuff on the plugins that you can look at for was really expanding, you know, how you can use the software. I was tickled with the, I mean, I've been using it for a while, but I didn't realise there's a little drop-down menu which sort of says Earth. And if you press on that, a long list of other, you know, like not moons, planets, dwarf planets, even meteors and things, which you can like set it to that and then look at the sky, the night sky from, say, Mars or from Jupiter. It's absolutely amazing. And then I spent this morning going back in time. It really was like having a TARDIS and going back to July 1969, setting it to the moon. And then, like, going for the moonwalk, that first moonwalk, you know, with Neil Armstrong.
So you can travel in time and travel in space.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is the TARDIS. But it's great. And they've even got, you can change the landscape as well. So if you are viewing from Jupiter, they've got, a landscape that looks like a Jovian landscape. It's great.
There's so many useful kind of plugins on that. One of the things I thought was really good was that you could get different views through different combinations of equipment and eyepieces or cameras. So if you've got, say, like, you know, a Canon DSLR hooked up to a Skywatcher Newtonian telescope, you can plug in all the right numbers for that, and it'll tell you what the field of view is going to be, and then it'll give you a little overlay so you can see prior to taking the photo what your photo is going to look like.
It is the depth of and width of features in that software is amazing. Yeah. I mean, you can tell that it's been championed by astronomers, because, like you say, it's all those things that they want are now being built for it. And if there's something new comes up, then you can bet that the software will develop again to encapsulate new technological developments.
Yeah, that's right. And it's all free.
Yeah, it's also like it's a great thing for beginners, because quite often on Facebook and Twitter we get kind of people saying, you know, when's the best place to see, or when's the best time to see this particular event in the night sky from my location. And if you don't download this Stellarium software, you can enter in your coordinates and the date and time, and you can look up and see what the night sky will look like from your point of view. So it's not just for kind of hardcore astronomers. It's kind of really good for beginners who are just kind of wanting to see what they can see, even with the naked eye.
Yeah,
well, I'm pretty much a beginner, and I'm addicted to it. It's just like the more you use it, the more you want to use it. So.
Yeah.
But speaking of stars, I suppose our kind of main feature in the issue this month is the strangest stars in the universe. There are about 100 billion stars in the Milky Way. So obviously there are examples of stars that kind of challenge what we know about stars and how they operate and how they form and evolve and die. Exoplanets, there are always kind of really strange types of stars. Our news editor, Elizabeth Pearson, has put together a feature about some of the strangest stars in the universe. So I just picked out some of my favourites from the feature. One of the stars has forming exoplanets in orbit around it, which have carved this kind of dusty circumstellar disk around the star into like a spiral shape, like a galaxy. So if you actually look at the star face on, it looks a bit like a spiral galaxy just because of the way the planets have been orbiting.
How confusing. You'd think that, you know, a planetary system could be a little bit different to a galaxy. Come on.
One star has the mass of the sun crammed into a space about a third the diameter of Earth. And apparently this star's carbon core has actually crystallized to create a diamond that is 10 billion trillion trillion carats.
Oh, man. I can't help thinking of that there's some kind of race of intelligent beings chipping away at it.
Yeah, I got a sci-fi heist movie in my head now. Stealing the biggest diamond in the universe. Yeah.
My third and final pick from the feature is a supernova, which is, as most people probably know, is an exploded star. And this one was spotted brightening in the sky and then fading away, which is normal enough, but then actually rising in brightness again. So it kind of almost appearing to die, but then coming to life. And the star also appears to be evolving 10 times slower than would be expected. So it appears 60 days old when it's actually 600 days old. And apparently that there are very kind of various explanations for all the different elements that make up just how weird it is. But there's no explanation for all these things put together, so astronomers still don't really know what's going on with this star. It's a great feature as he's put together, and she's actually spoken to some of the people who discovered the stars. So if kind of stellar oddities are your thing, that's probably the feature for you. And also, speaking of stars, Chris, there's a pretty good mission to map the Milky Way ongoing.
That's right. I was just blown away by the second data release from the Gaia mission, which is ESA's mission to map our galaxy, the Milky Way, in a whole new kind of level of precision. And it's just amazing when you think of some of the numbers. It's mapped over a billion stars, 1.3 billion stars. And actually, I said three dimensions. It's actually six dimensions. If you take dimensions in the kind of fairly loose sense, it's actually six dimensions. So it's position, distance, proper motion, brightness, colour, and velocity of. And that's not. They don't have a billion stars, all six dimensions. They've got three dimensions for a billion, but you know, millions of stars are. You can get six-dimensional view from them. It's just incredible.
It is. I mean, I know awesome is a devalued word these days, but, like, reading through that feature, it was awesome.
It really
did make your mind go poof.
Yes. That's right. I mean, and it's not just stars that this is mapped. It, you know, over its 5 years that it's been scanning the sky out in space, it's picked up asteroids, exoplanets, quasars, supernovae, you know, so it's done the whole, almost every area of astronomy is going to be affected by this, and it's going to be, you know, the kind of the go-to piece of data for many years to come for professionals.
Equally fascinating was also, I mean, the numbers from out there were amazing, but like some of the numbers they had of people who were working on it down here were amazing as well. It's like number crunching sweatshops all over all over the globe, you know, like, everybody feverishly working to get this data, like, into something, you know, from raw data to something that means something.
It's amazing how many
people are involved,
isn't it? And it's quite. Because I think one of the really interesting things about the feature is it shows you what the astronomers are dealing with, the raw data that comes in. It's literally just figures in a spreadsheet, isn't it? And then they've got to actually turn that into something meaningful and you know, kind of make inferences and stuff there. So it's fascinating work that they do. Yeah, and on the subject of fascinating work, I talked to the UK's principal investigator in the Gaia Data Processing Consortium, who's actually handling this mass of this data haul, Professor Jerry Gilmore. And I talked to him about what Gaia will enable astronomers to do.
Well, this is fundamental astronomy, so it underpins everything that we do in astrophysics, and in fact, much more than in astrophysics. There's lots of geophysics and fundamental physics as well. Basically, because this is the precision geometry on which everything else in the subject depends. So there's only one fundamental way to measure distances. That's using parallax. That's the slight angle difference between your two eyes. And everything else just follows from Euclid. I mean, it's as simple as that. When you can measure that little angle, you can measure a distance. If you repeat that angle over time, then you can measure a speed. And once you know a position and a speed, then you know fundamental properties of objects, you know, where they are and how they're moving. And you can deduce all sorts of other bits of physics from them. But without that information, we're running blind.
Mm-hmm. So this really runs the whole gamut of astronomy, from planning for space missions to astrophysics to cosmology to studying the orbits of planets and that kind of thing.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, as well as all the astrophysics that is done directly on the Gaia data, quite literally every single new mission, big ground-based facilities and space missions planned for the next 25 years is based on the Gaia data set. These things wouldn't work without the Gaia data there. So there are an awful lot of people who had nervous fingers crossed until a week ago.
So the last big major astrometry mission previous to Gaia was Hipparchos in the 1990s. How is Gaia different from that?
Well, Hipparchos was a pathfinder, as was its name. It was designed to prove the technology that Gaia uses. So it was very small. And it studied a relatively small number of stars, maybe 100,000 stars, to what was better than you could do from the ground, but was only moderate precision. And so compared to 100,000 stars with moderate precision, Gaia's got 1.5 billion with 1,000 times better precision. So more than 1,000 and mostly more than 10,000 times advance on Hipparchos in every way. And in fact, more bluntly, this really is the first time ever that mankind has opened this window into space. We've never before known what space was like in 3D. We've never before known how things moved.
Wow, that's pretty impressive, yeah. So Gaia began its imaging campaign in 2014 and it's still ongoing. Why is it that Gaia's cameras record each star multiple times?
The mission will probably continue till about 2024. That's when the spacecraft will run out of fuel. So all going well, it'll be a 10-year observation cycle. But the reason that we keep scanning the sky time after time is, first of all, that we have to follow the change in angle as the Earth moves around the Sun, because we use the two ends of Earth's orbit as our two eyes. That angle's different for every star, so we have to do it. And in principle, if you did that for just 2 years, that would be enough to actually measure. But in fact, stars, as well as being distant from us and having parallax, they also move. They have proper motion, so their own individual motions. So to get enough information to be able to distinguish between proper motion, which is the orbit of a star in the Milky Way, and the parallax, which is in fact the orbit of the Earth about the Sun, then you need to observe the star repeatedly. It's also the case that many, possibly essentially all, stars have companions, either another star or planets. And they change and they revolve around each other on all sorts of different timescales. So if you want to find a planet that goes around its parent star, what these things that are called hot Jupiters that go around in a couple of months or even less time, then you can see that with just 2 months of observation. But if you wanted to find Jupiter or Saturn, you're going to have to observe its parent star for 10 years to see the effect of it. So the longer we go on, the more things we can observe, which are new types of things.
Gaia's data doesn't just contain information on stars, its observational help in the solar system as well. What are some of the things it's observed closer to home here?
Well, this latest data release was just a sampler, massive though it was. And so in there, there's a few tens of thousands of precision orbits of asteroids. Now, these were a selected subset of the ones that are easy to process. So they're mostly known main belt asteroids. But the orbits of each individual one is about 100 times better from just 2 years of Gaia data than it is from the accumulated history of ground-based observations. And pretty soon that will be the case for tens of millions of asteroids. So every single one will have its orbit known much better than it's known now. Now, that's important or of interest, not only to improve the classification of asteroids into families, but also as the asteroids go close to each other, they slightly perturb the orbit. So we can use those perturbations to weigh the asteroids. So we'll get real masses and densities. Therefore, we'll know the physical properties of asteroids themselves. But even more fun than that, because Gaia's out beyond the Earth and looking back, Gaia looks back essentially to the orbit of Venus. And so we're discovering asteroids that actually live between us and the Sun. And normally, you can't see those, of course, because they're by definition, they're up in the daytime, right? So you go out, the daytime sky's bright, you can't see it. Goodness knows what there is in the way of a killer asteroid with a big smirk on its face waiting to take you out. Well, Gaia is going to find those. And another thing, one of the early uses of the Gaia data was the reference frame. So there are NASA spacecraft in the very outer parts of the solar system. In fact, one that went past Pluto and now going out to...
New Horizons.
Yeah, that's right. And it's going out to try and image a very distant asteroid in the solar system. So they've used Gaia data to improve their knowledge of where the spacecraft is. The map, it navigates by the stars, so its own navigation is improved, but also to improve the orbit of the asteroid, its target. And so just a couple of weeks ago, they had to use the Gaia data because they didn't have enough fuel on for two burns of their rockets to do their fine-tuning. And so they waited till they got the Gaia data to do their single-shot orbit improvement to get it. So that's already a practical application.
What about with dark matter? How will Gaia's measurements help determine where that is?
We weigh things basically by comparing the way things are distributed in space with how fast they're moving. So essentially, if you have a particular distribution, if things are moving slowly, it doesn't take much weight to hold them there. If they're moving fast, it takes a lot more weight to hold them there. So we can do that. That technique was developed by Arab astronomers to weigh the Earth using the height of the atmosphere, actually, a long time ago, clever people. But it's exactly the same methodology we use today. Except we use stars, and looking at how stars are distributed in the Milky Way, we can weigh different bits of the Milky Way. And so up until now, we've just been able to do one experiment, which tells us how much dark matter there is near the Sun, and one other experiment, which tells us the total mass of the Milky Way, neither terribly accurately, actually. Now we can do that experiment in all sorts of different places around the Milky Way. So we can weigh spiral arms, we can weigh different bits of the galaxy, we can look and see if there are some bits of the galaxy that are just much, much heavier than they should be, in which we can say, hey, there's a whole lot of dark matter in there. People have already put a lot of effort into improving determinations of the total mass of the Milky Way using Gaia orbits. It's one of the very popular early uses of Gaia data, is to try and weigh the entire Milky Way.
So has it come up with a figure then for the weight of the Milky Way?
It's not definitive, but it's creeping up. Yep. I mean, the Milky Way's just got about maybe twice as heavy as it was a week ago.
And is that is it kind of conforming to models of how much baryonic matter, standard matter that we can see there is, and how much of this dark hidden matter that there is?
Well, it is in part, and it isn't in part. It is in part in the sense that the total mass of the Milky Way and globally how the dark matter is distributed is starting to look a bit more sensible. There were some pretty strange-looking results based on older data. It's starting to look more sensible. But the other feature that comes with that is the distribution of recent accretion onto the Milky Way, so what you see when you look in the outer parts and what you see when you look around the Sun. And that doesn't agree with galaxy formation models at all, and never has done, actually. I think the Milky Way has always been considered as a 1 in 100 out rogue by the people who build galaxy models, whereas the people like us who observe the Milky Way say, well, your galaxy model's just wrong, isn't it? And I think that's becoming much clearer. We have a very great deal still to learn about how galaxies form and evolve. And in fact, that's the bottom line ambition for the whole Gaia program is to set the Milky Way up as a Rosetta Stone at which we can test everything against it. So not only galaxy formation models, but when we go and look at some fuzzy blob halfway across the universe, we can say, well, that should actually look pretty much like this stage of the Milky Way's evolution, and so then we've got something that we can compare it to.
So how much of the Milky Way has Gaia surveyed?
Well, of the 1.5 billion stars in the latest catalogue, most of those, maybe 1.25 billion, are within about 4 kiloparsecs. So that's about halfway to the galactic centre from here. And so in a circle like that, so most of those stars are in that bubble, a few thousand light years across. And so that part of the Milky Way is studied with great detail. But all the more luminous, intrinsically luminous stars, Gaia can see them all the way out way beyond the Milky Way, actually. Gaia can actually see individual stars moving in the Andromeda Nebula. So as far out as the Milky Way goes, and that's another question that we don't know the answer to yet, but we will probably do in the next few weeks, what is the most distant star that we can find? And they're a long way away. They're probably the most distant stars that are actually attached to the Milky Way are, again, about maybe twice as far away as we thought previously. So the Milky Way's just suddenly got 6 times bigger, as well as a bit heavier. And so the whole volume is sampled, just with more resolution as you get closer to us.
So the data release is just the first stage. And like you said, there's already been some interpretations of the data from the scientific community, like measuring the mass of the Milky Way and seeing which is the furthest star can be identified. What have you found interesting from the kind of the scientific papers released on the Gaia data so far?
Well, they're roaring out these papers, actually. There were 12 of them yesterday morning, 12 research papers just in one morning. That's not bad. But they cover everything. So there was one very nice little study that looked at the nearest failed brown dwarf star as a T dwarf, technically. So this thing's maybe 10 or 25 times the mass of Jupiter. But it's a free-floating star. It's just found it's very close to us, actually. It's going to come very close to us. This is one that's heading towards us. But using the Gaia data, they're able to classify that. So that's the very low luminosity, very nearby thing. There's in the several papers immediately started looking at the white dwarf sample in Gaia, because white dwarfs are intrinsically very luminous. This is the end point of evolution of all normal stars. So it's an Earth-sized diamond crystal, basically. But it turns out there's 2 types of white dwarfs, and it was always known there were 2 types. There's no, things like our sun will turn into, which is basically a single star evolves into this giant diamond crystal. But in cases where you have 2 stars, binary stars, very close together, the evolution of the star, surviving star is disrupted before it can get to that very late stage. And so they form a lower mass white dwarf, so it's still got lots of helium in it, so it's called a helium white dwarf. And one of the things that came out on day one of the Gaia data is just looking at the intrinsic luminosity and colour of the 25,000 white dwarfs. I mean, previously there were only a few hundred known. The accuracy was so great, you could actually see the difference just by eye looking. You can just see a different distribution in the figures of between the helium white dwarfs and the hydrogen white dwarfs. And so just there, this is the tells us the history of the effect of binary stars on the evolution of all stars. Bang. I mean, that's spectacular. So they're the low luminosity objects, but also, of course, people went up the other extreme, and there's a much improved calibration of the cosmological distance scale using Cepheids, the bright, young, luminous, pulsating stars, and also long period variables. That's intermediate mass stars in the very late stages of evolution when they're huge and they're pulsating irregularly on timescales of up to years. Cepheids, it's days, but years. So these things you can see a very long way across the universe, and they're the things that calibrate the distance to 1A supernovae and attempt to improve our knowledge of the Hubble constant. And although the last word won't be out for several years yet, the current calibration of the nearby supernovae from the Gaia distance scale is just interestingly different than what it should have been according to cosmology. So there's a real, there's a 3-sigma discrepancy between the local universe as measured and the local universe as predicted. And that's really interesting. So we may be learning, maybe about to learn something fundamental about general relativity and the nature of dark energy. So again, you see Gaia is contributing on every scale, dark matter, dark energy, but also to stars, stellar evolution, right down to asteroid orbits.
You've been involved with Gaia since the very beginning, haven't you, since its early days. How do you go about starting a mission like this?
Actually, it seems innocent and easy at the time. You're working on stuff, and this was back in the early 1990s. It was the beginning of the modern digital science astronomy region, studying the Milky Way. So I was one of the pioneers of that process and was discovering things left, right, and centre. And so it was obvious that what you needed, the next step after these big sky surveys, which were just starting, the next step was a survey in three dimensions, or in six dimensions, actually, by getting speed as well. And so it was an obvious thing to ask for. And in fact, the timing coincidentally was dead right, because the Apakos mission you mentioned was still going, but they already had enough information to know that the method was going to work. And so then it was, in a rather silly phrase, just technology. We wrote a proposal saying we'd quite like $1 billion of technology, please. And eventually got it.
just a casual letter on the right headed notepaper, and that.
Well, it just about was, actually. The original proposal was, I think, 4 pages long. I mean, they're very short. And then, of course, by the time you've finished, decade later, when you're ready to actually start building the thing, you've got books and books and books of detailed stuff. But it does start with just an ambition. Everything starts with an ambition.
And you've stuck with it throughout its kind of development and throughout its evolution of the mission. Are there some parts of a mission that are more challenging than others in terms of seeing it through and keeping the kind of development of it going?
Yes, I've been leading the UK involvement in this for a quarter of a century now, which is a very long time. So, I mean, the most challenging thing is to make sure you start when you're young so that you're still alive a quarter of a century later. That was a bit of clever planning. The real discovery for me and Gaia is how clever engineers are, actually. The people, many in the UK, people in Cheltenham who built the sensors, people in Stevenage who built the avionics, people in Toulouse who built the structure. They're really clever people. I mean, that's just such fun things they do. They're lucky people. Great life they have. Great, exciting stuff. So it's been a great pleasure to work with engineers and technical people. And the rest of it, there's a certain intellectual interest in managing large numbers of people, but also in the science and seeing. One of the strange things about Gaia, just because it's unique, this is the first time we've ever done serious astrometry in space. All the things we said back in the 1990s we wanted to do have not been done in the meantime, because there wasn't another mission that tried to do it. And so those same questions we asked in 1995 are the ones that are being answered today. That's remarkable. But normally technology and science advances so fast that you start building a telescope to do something, and in the meantime, you've done it. So you end up doing something else with your telescope. But Gaia is unusual in that sense, is that there is nothing else. Gaia is unique.
That was Professor Jerry Gilmore. You can find out more about the Gaia mission and Professor Gilmore's involvement in the June issue of BBC Sky Night magazine.
There's lots to see in the night sky this month, which you can find out all about in our guide to the night sky in this month's issue. But if there's one thing you really should see, it's noctilucent clouds. Our June issue features a wealth of information about observing and photographing NLCs, as they're known. But you don't really need any fancy equipment to spot them. The best time to look for them is about an hour and a half to 2 hours after sunset, typically look low above the northwest horizon. Or if you get up early enough, you can look a similar time before sunrise. That time, look low above the northeast horizon. And these shining clouds are created high up in the mesosphere. They're actually the highest altitude clouds in our atmosphere. And they're created as light shines off ice crystals, producing a really silvery kind of blanket display. They're quite captivating when you see them, and as they're relatively easy to see, they're a fantastic way of getting kids and young people looking up at the sky.
So that's it from us this month. You can find out more about the Gaia mission and noctilucent clouds in the June issue of BBC Sky Night magazine, in which we also look at some of the top historical astronomical attractions you can visit this summer in the UK, a mission to study noctilucent clouds up close and the search for dark matter. Plus, our regular sections helping you unlock the wonders of the night sky, find the right equipment to observe it with, and discover the best things to see after dark this month. From all of us here at BBC Sky Night magazine, and until next month, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Fletcher. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or simply head to iTunes.